We've been sterilizing all the gems, all the good dogs. We're sterilizing them. They are almost extinct. And we are seeing a much larger proportion of borderline gray area dogs and a much higher proportion of dangerous dogs.
Hey everyone, I'm Mike Shikashio, and in this episode, I chat with Sue Sternberg, a world-renowned dog behavior expert who has devoted her personal and professional life to helping dogs and people live together happily. We talk about the street dogs we had the pleasure of observing when we were together in Valle de Bravo, Mexico, and the profound difference in behavior with dogs in the United States. I also pick Sue's brain on her fascinating insight into dog body language and red flags for aggression. And we dive deeper into the reason why we might be seeing an increase in aggression cases overall. Hopefully this episode will generate some much-needed conversation about how we're getting dogs and bringing them into our human lives. And this episode is sponsored by AggressiveDog.com, where you can find a variety of educational offerings with a focus on helping dogs with aggression, including the Aggression in Dogs Master Course, the most comprehensive course available anywhere in the world on helping dogs with aggression. And the Aggression in Dogs Conference, a three-day virtual event happening from October 2nd to 4th, 2020, with 10 amazing speakers, all experts in their field. You can find out more about the conference by going to thelooseleashacademy.com. Hey everyone, I'm here with the insightful and eagle-eyed Sue Sternberg. Sue has been working in shelters and as a dog trainer since 1981. Sue was the 2016 recipient of the APDT's Lifetime Achievement Award. She founded the shelter featured in the HBO documentary, Shelter Dogs. Her over 40 years of canine behavior experience includes as a dog control officer, behavior consultant at the ASPCA, shelter owner, successful competitor in a variety of dog sports, with nose work being her current wild favorite, and a teacher of dog trainers worldwide, including myself. She has published many books and DVDs on all aspects of dog behavior, training and assessments available through dogwise.com and tawserdog.com. So welcome, Sue.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. I'm really excited about this episode. Let's reminisce a little bit. Actually, the first time I met you in person was in Mexico. We were both presenting at the SICA conference for our friend Darwin Anguil. And it's where we kind of presented at the conference, and then Darwin took us to this little sleepy seaside or lakeside town in old Mexico, this beautiful town called Valle de Bravo. And it's just such a breathtaking place. But one of the things that we saw a lot of was the street dogs there, just these dogs that are out on the streets. And, you know, you and I were both, there's so many beautiful sights, but then you and I were both, let's go see the dog.
I know.
Right?
I know.
So let's talk about those dogs a little bit. You know, it's just fascinating the difference in behavior between street dogs and dogs here in the U.S. that might be owned or confined to certain levels or degrees of extreme confinement in some cases. So what did you see there? What was your takeaway from those dogs?
Their lower arousal levels and they seemed to me as an interpretation so fulfilled, it's like they woke up in the mornings and they knew their schedules and they could, their schedules were their own, right? And I remember getting up at like 5 in the morning and I'd step right out of the motel that we were staying at. And there was always a dog or two walking by and they were food foraging. And then I would remember we saw them throughout the day. By the end of, I don't know, we were there 3 days. Were we there like 3 days?
I think so, yeah.
Three nights maybe. I could recognize a lot of the dogs and I knew where they belonged. And they would have their routes throughout the day, going to the square to beg for food. And many of them belonged to shop owners and you'd see them in their stores with the shop owner, you know, in the afternoons when it was hot. But the dogs, they just had a contentment about them. And, you know, you'd think, oh, well, their lives are really stressful. They got to get worried about, you know, getting hit by a car or where their next meal's coming from. But I don't know, they seemed a lot less stressed than a lot of pet dogs.
I agree. I think there was just a profound lack of aggression.
Yes.
You know, and you didn't see any dogs that were, you know, barking and lunging and growling. It was just, they have this unique way of communicating, or I should say more normal way of communicating with each other. And they're just so seasoned at it because, you know, they're constantly communicating all the time. I remember I think you had one dog that was following you around, sort of your pet while you were there, showing up, kind of staying at the, you know, waking up, and the dog would be at the hotel steps too sometimes. And it's, you know, I think one of the things that like a lot of people will say, oh, those poor dogs, those poor street dogs, we got to rescue them. You know, we got to take them home. It's, you know, they're living a good life.
They are.
You know, they're having a good old time.
They really, they are. I mean, I think, you know, every once in a while you'll see one with a medical problem. And if you could solve just, you know, getting them veterinary help if and when they need it, which is rare, I think, then they could be really fulfilled. Then there were only a couple that were limping. One was limping because I think she had a dog bite wound on her leg. And by the end of the 3 days, she was not limping that much. But all the other dogs, like, you know, they have enough food. They're not thin and they're not fat either. And they just, I don't know. I feel like they had all their needs fulfilled, plus the need that to have a job or a function. And I think a lot of our pet dogs don't know what their function is, right? Like, I think they're alone a lot of the day, and even when they're not, I'm not sure. Maybe it's just that we do their schedule for them, and maybe it's not what they would choose.
Right. It's kind of that lack of control and choice in a lot of the dogs' environments here.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so interesting. And you mentioned the health aspect. And yes, you see some dogs limping around happily. Right. And if you were to describe it, they're just, you know, they don't seem like it's really affecting their mental health much. They're very happy.
Yeah. And I'm telling you, I see so many pet dogs who are in pain and have all sorts of issues that nobody's recognizing. Like, if, you know, we look at the street dogs and you can see one limping and you can drive by and go, oh, you know, that's just awful. He's suffering. They should be rescued and get help. And I'm like, well, what about all the pet dogs? What about the pet dogs that are in pain and no one has diagnosed it? No one's noticed it, you know? That makes me sad too. I just think we can't assume that pet dogs is the pinnacle of how a dog should live, especially when you visit other countries like this. I don't know. I think we should always be asking ourselves, are we doing the best by our dogs as individuals, as communities, and as, you know, as a larger question too, I guess.
Yes. The big profound question, and we're going to shift gears towards that topic. I think one thing I hope in my future is that I'm put out of business because there's less aggression out there, and then I can go maybe shift jobs to flying around the world and observing street dogs or something. That would be my dream job.
Don't get your hopes up, Michael. Okay, not going to happen soon.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about how we can help dogs and the sense of what we can observe. So I've seen many of your talks at different conferences, always fascinating. I love your insight, and that's why I mentioned you're the eagle-eyed observer when I introduced you, because you have this real keen sense of observing dogs and what they're doing, their behaviors. And so let's talk about some of those red flags for aggression. Mm-hmm. That you see that are not very overt, or even for some of us as behavior professionals might miss.
To me, the first sign of red alert, of risk, of me being immediately more careful about how I communicate with a dog or even just observe them, is a lack of overt signs of sociability. Like, literally, if the dog is not actively seeking social contact with me or the person, to me, that's just the first red flag. And a red flag to me is a tiny behavior that I just store on a post-it on my head where I would say, you know, let me make sure I just notice that. No matter, I don't interpret it, I don't know what it means, but I do want to verbalize it and notice it. But here's a weird one. And I don't have a great quantity or quantifiable way to describe it, but the dog's not moving his feet very often. In other words, he starts planting his feet and he's just not moving very much. And I don't have a number of footsteps per second where I could tell you that it now, you know, turns into he's not moving his feet very much as opposed to is, but foot movement is really important. And that's true for sitting or standing, although usually they're standing and not moving very much. And that is one of the signs that happens when a dog's getting closer to an aggression threshold. The next sign is that's odd is the tail, the base of the tail, either raising when a human starts to interact with a dog, pet it, you know, talk to a dog or, you know, love on the dog, or the tail was, the base of the tail was high and it stays high. That's another risk. And then, you know, I think there's like a split spectrum of risks. So there's the low arousal dog that's getting tighter and stiller. And then there's the high arousal dog who looks just excited or breathing hard, eyes wide, panting, high energy, and energy's dissipating out in a non-goal oriented way. And both types of dogs can be close to an aggression threshold.
So do you see that in a certain time frame? Are you, when you're observing these, do you see it in a few minutes of observation, or is it over several observations?
Oh, that's a great question. No, it can be within just a few seconds. It can be literally in a still frame that red flags can come out. Yeah,
it's interesting. It's this, I think I'm kind of on the same page as that as you, as being able to see things that over time, it takes a long time to really start picking up on those, but you start to, it's almost like profiling where you start to see certain body language signatures that come out.
Yeah.
And you kind of predict what happens next in a lot of cases.
Did you read Malcolm Gladwell's Blink?
I have not.
Okay, it's a really interesting book, but that whole book is about the thin slicing, the ability of experienced people, whatever their field of experience is, to be able to instantly look at whatever their passion has been and see a tremendous amount. Like the book opens up with an art appraiser. And they were looking at some Greek statue that has been appraised by a million professionals because this museum's thinking of buying it and it's extremely expensive. And then they had this last, maybe it was just during an opening or something, and this expert who had not been called in, and she literally took one look at it and said, "Oh, I hope you're not spending your money on that fake." And so she saw in an instant what all these experts had done, you know, carbon dating and scraping or whatever. And I feel like you spend enough time with dogs as an objective observer and you can thin slice. So even if you scroll through Pet Finder ads on shelters and you look, and I often sort of play a game where I'm like, which dog do I think seems the most problematic? Which dog do I think seems the least problematic? And then you read whatever profiles, if there are any, right?
Right. It's an interesting way of learning those kind of, the body language involved. Because I always recommend to my students as well, you know, go on YouTube and just search up the term like dog bite or dog attack videos.
Yes.
And you can learn a lot about body language just by watching that. Because let's face it, we're not witnessing in person dog aggression incidents at a high frequency. At least we hope not. So when you can start to get a wide range of seeing it in other places, you can learn quite a bit by watching those. So let's talk about, there's a couple other interesting terms you have for body language. One of them, which always gets interesting reaction from the audience, is the anal swipe. So what is that? Describe that one.
Okay, so there's four of these behaviors that I think they are part of a scent marking cluster. So there's an anal swipe, and I'll describe it in a sec. There's the anal plant, which is the duration behavior that goes with the anal swipe. Then there's the shoulder swipe and the shoulder stance, which is the duration behavior for the shoulder swipe. So an anal swipe is when the dog's his tail is always in a position at the moment of contact that it's usually raised. Again, when I was saying earlier that that high tail or the raised base means something, and I think it just happened, like which comes first? Does the tail raise, which allows the anus to deliver more scent, or is the, you know, does it happen the other way around? But an anal swipe is when the dog's tail is high and he'll turn in such a way so that his anus comes, either makes contact, fleeting contact, or comes within about 2 inches of either you, furniture, wall, other dog. And then the anal plant is usually they'll sit on your shoe or your foot, or like I had a dog, my dog Hop Sing, and he would sit on my lap and lean his butt on my shoulder to sort of perch up there. And his anus was always planted on my shoulder. and so the anal swipe and then a shoulder swipe is what cats look like when they scent mark. Cats usually start with a cheek or side of their face. Dogs don't usually. The dog's shoulder swipe, it really starts with an arching of the neck and then they travel back toward their rear end. And at some point, the shoulder again, makes either fleeting contact or comes within a couple of inches of the person. And these are, I think these are resource claiming. When I say resource guarding behaviors, I don't mean in terms of aggression, but in just in terms of controlling access or claiming something that's important to the dog. And I only consider these red flag behaviors in the absence of either a relationship with the dog or in the absence of sociability. And so, and that's the same as it works in a human-human relationship. Like the greatest risk to one couple of people is if one treats the other one like property and claims them as their own, and not the relationship isn't primarily based in love and shared joy and respect. Same as dog human, human dog.
That's really interesting. Now, would you see the shoulder stance in dogs that are protecting their owners?
You bet.
So let's say working you on. Yeah.
Oh yeah. You'll see it in all the guarding breeds, flock guardians, like the, just any of, most of the working group will do it, but you could see it in, you see it in sporting dog. You could see it in any dog. But they will, it's a blocking stance and they usually position themselves obliquely or in profile to the owner. And the side that they favor of the owner is usually the side that blocks the closest competitor. And so I remember I was sitting in an auto repair place waiting room, and I was alone, and it was kind of a U-shaped set of chairs around a coffee table with very boring magazines. And I was alone. I'm sitting in there, and I had my dog Hop Sing with me, my shoulder anal swiper. He's long dead, but he was a cool dog. And I had him lying down at my feet while I read a magazine. And I don't know, after about 20 minutes, another customer walked in, a man, and he sat down in one of the chairs. I kind of nodded and smiled, said hi. And I kept reading. And then I looked down, and Hop Sing had repositioned himself and was now lying down obliquely in front of me, now blocking me from the man. There was no growling, no threat, no suspiciousness. It was just, he had repositioned himself. And that was it's a shoulder stance in the lying down position, but it felt like in my bonded good relationship with Hop Sing, it felt great. Like I felt so like, thank you, Hop Sing. And it felt really appropriate. If and when I meet shelter dogs or dogs that I'm not that familiar with and they're not familiar with me and they start swiping me or giving me a shoulder stance, I'm less grateful and a little bit more on edge because I'm being treated as property and it's not what I want to be treated as unless we have a relationship.
So you feel there's a potential for risk,
yes,
further on down the line if you were to continue to interact with that dog?
It could be, or the risk could lower, but it puts a little red flag up. It's also something I notice absolutely when dealing with owners. So, you know, if the dog repositions himself. Again, it doesn't mean that there's that aggression is coming or the dog's thinking of aggression. It's just, it's an observation I want to make because it tells me there's some resource claiming and possible resource guarding coming on.
What other behaviors do you see like that? So I've seen dogs, maybe they mount and clasp, so onto somebody's leg.
Yes.
So not just like a mounting, humping kind of behavior, but
yes.
They're clasping yeah. with the forelimbs.
Yeah. That's, I think, claiming, and usually even the nails dig in. So I think their claws are extended, if I can call them claws. So people are always like, oh, he had sharp toenails. And I'm like, no, he was also, you know, extending them in a way. And then the wrists are bent. So it's really claspy. I think there is a component to the clasping and mounting and clasping of ownership, guarding, resource claiming. I also, and this will make me sound like a creep for sure, I think there's an element of what I have now termed genitalia smearing. So I think that there is some scent marking happening with the penis or the vulva, depending on the sex of the dog. But also, it's really interesting, if you freeze frame a dog who is mounting, the position is the same as in defecation, where and there's a marking component to defecation with dogs, right? And so I think mounting, defecating, clasping, all of that is in this bubble of this cluster of scent marking claiming behaviors.
Yeah, it's so interesting that you're talking about this because I'm thinking back to the small handful of times I've had dogs pee on me in the past and leg lifting on me. And all of those cases, I just was, you know, I was able to work with the dog, but there was never that relationship that you're talking about.
So yeah, yeah.
Not able to like form a real, like the dog was just there in the moment, but not really interested in what you mean. Kind of go through the motions.
Right.
Not a social. Warm fuzzy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
Super,
right?
Super interesting. Yeah. All right. Let's move on to... you know, these, actually, let's talk about puppies first, you know, so we're talking about red flags for most adult dogs, but what about puppies?
Same. You see the same things. I think you see in general, most puppy behaviors and motor patterns, I'm talking like 8-9 weeks and higher, are similar, if not the same as in adults in terms of what I'm observing, you know, the minutiae of body language. Certainly there are puppies who have all adult body language and motor patterns. And while I don't think that's normal, I think it's not uncommon more and more, especially. I've seen puppies anal swipe and anal plant. Puppies under 8 or 9 weeks, I don't think move the base of their tails the way adult dogs do. And I'm not even sure, I haven't observed enough puppies of enough different breeds and sizes to say that it's 8 or 9 weeks where I think their tails are readable like adult dogs. So I'd have to, see me again in a year. And I'll study puppies until then. I've been trying to study puppies anyway. But I think a lot of a freeze, you'll see puppies freeze in the same way. I think... puppies often will get still in the same way that adult dogs do, heading toward an aggression threshold.
So how modifiable do you think the behavior is when you start seeing puppies exhibiting, you know, red flag behaviors or maybe even more overt aggression?
You know, I think people assume in a puppy that they're more malleable, and they are, I think, and that, you know, what you see in a puppy, don't worry about it because you can socialize them and, you know, you have all these critical periods still open. And when it comes to violence and aggression thresholds in puppies, I think the same holds true as in humans. I would rather see aggression thresholds in adolescents or adults than I would in young puppies. And it worries me more. And I know I'm a freak, but... I don't think aggression thresholds are that movable. I think they, through intense behavior modification, the building of the bond, shared joy, lots of joyous reward-based training, and shared experiences in nature, especially, I think we can build some buffers against and have that dog more slowly move towards his aggression thresholds. But I don't think we move them as much. I think they're fairly set. That in no way means that I don't believe in socialization and training and behavior modification, all of that. But I think we don't cure things. And I don't think we take the basic temperament out of the dog or change it that much. I think we pad it with all the good things that we try to do. And I've seen really young puppies with very low aggression thresholds in some categories. And one would have to raise them all and follow up to see what kind of, you know, if that's movable or not. And I've not done that. I don't know anyone who has, but I'm more worried about low thresholds in a young puppy than I am in an adolescent or an adult dog. I don't know how you feel about that.
I'm the same. I think, the analogy I use with my clients too, if they have a young puppy or even an adult dog, is that aggression threshold. I kind of just put my arm out in the air and I say, this is your dog's threshold. And we can bump that line up a little bit through behavior modification.
Yeah.
But things can easily bump that line back down. So if the dog's got a stressful day or there's other underlying medical issues or all these factors can make that line move around in space. And, you know, we're throwing darts at it sometimes. So the antecedents, as we speak, are the triggers. We're throwing darts. And sometimes they might land underneath that line, which we want, but sometimes they're going to hit over that line. And that's where you're going to get the aggressive response. So we never get rid of that line.
Yes.
We can push it up little by little, but sometimes it's going to float down. So that's why behavior change is that journey of, you know, it's not a straight line. It's up and down.
Yeah.
And the same thing with that threshold. We can adjust it, but we can't. It's always there.
Right. I would agree with that.
Yeah. So along those lines, let's talk about like adaptability and those factors. So we're talking about something like one factor, like a dog's aggression threshold. But this, as I'm sure you're very acutely aware of, is the many factors involved in adaptability.
Yeah, you bet.
So let's dive into that.
Yeah.
Let's what are factors that make dogs, you know, unadoptable or the criteria in your mind?
So the first thing I would say is that we can look at a dog and his aggression thresholds and his sociability, which I think are the factors that make up his temperament, not his personality as much, but his temperament. And I think aggression thresholds and sociability and the dog himself is intertwined with the trinity of dog-human environment. So there's this triangle that you can't separate, right? So I can say, here's this dog and he has a little bit of a low resource guarding threshold, aggression threshold. But nobody might notice it if he's with a certain kind of owner in a certain kind of environment, right? And so there are dogs, I call them the gems, these high sociability, high thresholds for all types of aggression. You could put them with bad people, you can put them in a bad environment, and they're still going to be okay. They're not going to hospitalize anyone. They're just generally stable, safe dogs. They don't go that far south. And so I call them the gems. On the far side of that are the dangerous dogs. And those are dogs with low thresholds in two or more categories of aggression and or low sociability or no sociability. That package is the dangerous dog. That's a much more unmanageable situation. In other words, even with a professional trainer, even with a controlled environment that you think you have, you know, rural, no visitors, whatever, the dangerous dog is unlikely to make it through life successfully without some sort of a serious event. And then we have the borderline dogs, the gray area dogs, those middle dogs. And usually the gray area dogs have either lower no sociability and higher thresholds in all categories of aggression, or they have one low threshold and high sociability or low sociability, but they require just the right person and just the right environment, and they generally require management at the very least, or luck, a series of good luck events throughout their life to be successful. Here's the fascinating thing: aggression thresholds matter. So In other words, if I'm looking at a shelter dog and I'm doing an assessment and I see that he's got a low threshold for dog-to-dog aggression, it may not manifest itself, that the threshold may not manifest itself in when the dog's in a home and in his environment as an aggressive event, but any low threshold for any of the categories of aggression predicts more severe problem behavior in categories seemingly having nothing to do with the low threshold. So what I mean by that, like to me, I boil down the threshold, the aggression in dogs into four categories. Dog-to-dog aggression is one. Stranger-directed aggression is two. Some people call that territoriality, but it's stranger-directed aggression, almost always fear-based, but not always. Third category is resource-guarding aggression. And the fourth category of aggression is, I call it aggression when made to do something he doesn't want to do, or aggression when prevented from doing what he does want to do. And it's usually a frustration intolerance, often has to do with handling, and sometimes arousal that package. And so let's say you have a dog with medium sociability and a low threshold for resource guarding. And that's how you assess him at the shelter. And let's say you decide you're going to rehome him. The problem is that's immediately a gray area dog. So I know that because of his temperament, he's going to need just the right person and just the right environment in his life to be successful. This is a completely unstudied section of the dog world. In other words, we have no idea who is that best person, what's that best environment. Currently, what shelters and rescues do is they take the gray area dog and they toss the sewing needle out ahead, and then they take a piece of thread and they hurl the thread after the needle, and they hope the thread goes through the needle, and they hope they've made a good triangle, a good placement. And what they count on, what they bank on, is the love that the person is going to feel for the dog and the bond. What as trainers, what we bank on is the fact that the person adopting that gray area dog will ultimately become a trainer, get so hooked into behavior and body language, they'll fall in love with it, they change their life, and they keep the dog, and they become a great dog trainer. The thing about the dog with a low threshold, especially like a low threshold for resource guarding, because we're interpreting some of the science that's coming out in the shelter world on resource guarding as it being not important for people adopting, and not important for assessing. And the problem with that is the studies only looked at dogs with low thresholds for resource guarding. They looked at food guarding in the home. And low threshold for resource guarding has such bigger implications. Food guarding is usually the lowest one. The low threshold resource guarder, if he or she is going to show aggression in the home, it almost always manifests itself as owner guarding, house, car, territorial guarding, and or dog-to-dog aggression in the home or at the dog park, again, related to owner guarding. And that's never been looked at in any of the science, the research that's being done on low threshold for resource guarding. But so take a dog with a low threshold for resource guarding, and let's say the dog also has either a low or no sociability. I can tell you that that dog's going to have separation anxiety. He's going to have some serious behavior problem, seemingly having nothing to do with resource guarding or even aggression. The dog's temperament, made up of these aggression thresholds and sociability package, can predict certain things. So the biggest problem in the shelter world, she says, having blathered on and on and on million tangents, coming back to the question about shelter dogs, but is that the population of dogs that we're seeing in our shelters today, we've been sterilizing all the gems, all the good dogs, we're sterilizing them. They are almost extinct. And we are seeing a much larger proportion of borderline gray area dogs and a much higher proportion of dangerous dogs in our shelters, all at a time where we're trying to not euthanize, and we're trying to raise our live release rates, raise the number of dogs that can either get reclaimed by owners, sent to rescue, or adopted out.
Yeah, lots to unpack there. I want to There's so much to talk about there. So what about bite history with dogs? So, and we're talking again, we're focusing on sheltered dogs, different than the cases that I work with versus, I just want to make that clear for the listener. So in sheltered dogs with a bite history, do you look at that? Do you consider that or look at the severity or the circumstances?
Here's the thing. I used to. I started working in a shelter in the 1981. I wasn't responsible for placing dogs then. By the time I was in the, let's say, the late 80s or early 90s, there were dogs that would come in and we would get a report from the owner. Oh, you know, he bit a child. And we would look at the dog. We didn't know anything about assessments. But we'd be like, this dog didn't bite anyone. And if it did, the kid would probably be doing something awful because this dog seems just great. So during that decade, I was not responsible, but I worked at shelters that did place those dogs. And I'm telling you, I don't think they worked out very often. The cases that I remember, and again, it's not a scientific data collecting, but many, if not most of them, came back as biters, and they continued to bite. One of the best predictors of future violence is prior violence. And so when you're placing shelter dogs, if the dog already has a bite record, here's the paradox, Michael. So you and I know exactly what that would mean, right? We hear that he bit, and he bit because he was out in his fenced yard with the owner, and the neighbor reached over the fence to pet him, and he bit the neighbor. We immediately, like, we see that, we put it into our category, we know where it comes from, what low threshold, we see it. And we also know immediately what it's like to live with that dog. We've either had that dog or we just, you know, we know what when it's going to be a problem. We know immediately the kind of management that's going to be necessary when that dog may try and bite. All of those things, we have it in our heads. And the paradox is that the only person who could adopt a dog who's a known biter should be somebody who's owned a biter before in that category of biters. Because the only people who really truly understand what it's like to live with a dog with a low threshold for one or more types of aggression is somebody who's lived with that dog. And the paradox is, even amongst professional dog trainers, when you've lived with that dog, you never want to not have known that dog. You love the dog very much. In fact, the bond with a dog who's got problems is very strong. But we always say to ourselves, for my next dog, I want a dog that I don't have to worry about. I want a dog that I can go to a hotel with. I want a dog I can go to the dog park with, whatever. And so what you realize, if you're trying to place a dog who's already bitten, what we're doing is we're duping somebody into taking the dog who really has no understanding of what that's like. And that I have a problem with.
I think Trish McMillan actually refers to it as like outsourcing euthanasia.
Yep, you bet. Right? You bet.
Yeah. And let's talk about that a little bit. So we're seeing, you know, I'm completely guilty of this early on when I first started out. You know, I thought I could work with the dogs, fix them, rehab them. You know, I watched a few episodes of The Dog Whisperer, so I could do this. I could foster dogs and fix them. And I quickly came to the realization that that's really not possible in most cases, or you can make things better. But again, it's so we're seeing this phenomenon happen over and over where someone loves dogs, well-meaning, very well-meaning, and no ill intent or malice at all. It's just they start a rescue or they start something going, and they're taking in dogs with sometimes very dangerous dogs in my experience. Yep. And, you know, what are your thoughts on that? What can we do to shift that process?
So I've been trying to shift that process for decades. And I've been trying to, because I've straddled the shelter world and the training world my whole life. And when you straddle both worlds, you have a different perspective, right? You can't sit in on a behavior consult with a family where they have a dog that you cannot fix. You can't even safely help them manage the dog. And there you are with this family sobbing. They are sobbing. They're completely devastated. You can't sit through that and say to yourself, I'm going to just keep placing these types of dogs because, you know, eventually they'll find a right home. And if you don't straddle that world, or if you don't understand the world of behavior modification and dog training, your concept of what is curable and how something is curable And you know, if a dog can be okay, I think is very skewed. Again, not intentionally, but I think people don't understand. I think people think, well, if he can trust, if the dog can learn to trust, that'll be okay. If he's shown a lot of love, everything will be okay. And they're not. So I've been trying to change this for decades. I'm not sure we can. The emotions run deep. And I'm not sure. I think what we, as with most things, I think what we have to do is try to increase the number of people doing the right thing and placing good dogs and placing good matches, right? Like really listening to people, what they want, and try to give them exactly the kind of dog that they want. I also think, and I think I'll just open up a new website as we speak called senddeaththreatstosuesternberg.com. Here, I think we have to start breeding pet dogs in this country. And I know that immediately there's a bunch of reputable breeders out there who are raising the flag and going, I'm already doing that. I'm breeding good pet dogs. And I'm like, yes, you are. Reputable breeders are out there breeding good dogs. There are not enough of them, not even close. And by being so reputable, they're selling dogs in spay-neuter contracts. They're not breeding every heat cycle. They're being really careful about, you know, how they breed. You're not breeding enough. We need far more great new breeders out there breeding first and foremost for high aggression thresholds, high sociability, and health. And health is behavioral and physical health. And not caring, not first and foremost sticking to conformation or a particular breed. We should literally be breeding the best pet dogs to the best pet dogs before they are all sterilized into extinction.
I would say I would agree 100% with that because of what we're seeing.
Yep.
Just this incredible increase in aggression cases.
Yes, right.
All throughout the states. And, you know, I think with that in mind, breeding for resiliency too, to the impacts of the environment that we're subjecting the dogs to now.
Yes, it's so harder to be a dog.
It's as we witnessed in other countries, you know, the dogs are really having a good time in a lot of times in the United States where we're asking them to, you know, stay at home 10 hours a day with no job and nothing to do and bring home another dog that might be beating up on them. And, you know, and there's just so many circumstances that they have to deal with. And it's, that's, you know, kind of was segueing to the next question about like, how can we make things better for, how can we put Mike Shikashio out of a job working with aggression cases and the perfect world. So what else would you like to see happen? And obviously an end to puppy mills, because that would mean there would be much more good breeders.
Well, here's the thing. Maybe it's not an end to puppy mills that we're looking at. Maybe, and hear me through, maybe it's changing puppy mills so that they become more humane, less large volume. But I know when you say puppy mill, you think of somebody's barn with, you know, cage upon cage of horrible conditions. But what we need are more large scale breeding to meet the demand. And I don't think you can really produce a great puppy in a large scale commercial environment. But I'm not even sure the way great breeders are breeding is the pinnacle, the best way to be breeding great pet dogs. I don't think we know yet exactly what that is, but I think we need way more breeding of good dogs. And I think we need to revamp the breeding system. I joined on Facebook Functional Breeding. It's Jessica Heckman. And I joined it because I think there's a website too, and I think she just started a Patreon page, but I'm really interested in it because I'm really interested in, can we start producing good pet dogs? Not that functional breeding is about, you know, breeding mixed breeds or breeding, it's just about better breeding. So one of the things is with high sociability, with high aggression thresholds comes stability. That's the thing. That package will bring behavioral health. That package will bring a dog, will produce a dog that's basically resilient to difficult environments, not enough exercise every day, and those sorts of traits that we really want. we have to breed it. And somehow we have to come to terms with the fact that the shelters are filling up with much more and more difficult dogs, much more aggressive dogs, and that we can't just keep placing them. We can't just keep, even if a shelter says, listen, we think this dog's, you know, going to bite, or we think this dog's dangerous, many shelters are being forced to send those dogs to rescue. And then rescue groups are very short-lived. They only usually last a few years, if that. Many of them are new, and many of them are run by people who have no idea about animal behavior. And then they are taking these dogs who are sometimes incredibly dangerous and putting them into a foster home, or placing them kind of willy-nilly, and then keeping you in business and you and a lot of other trainers.
Yes. And you mentioned something earlier about the demand. So we saw when the pandemic hit, everybody was going out and getting dogs. And guess what happened? I started getting a bunch of calls and requests for consults because their newly adopted dog, often coming up from the South, is, biting somebody in the family. And it's the same conversation over and over and over with those clients that are their news. And it's many of them are breaking down crying because they're attached to their dog, or they're good, is in air quotes, 99% of the time. And they don't understand why the aggression is happening and just once in a while. Right. And, and it's been some cases where it's been very dangerous for the owners and immediate, return to the shelter or rescue.
If they can, like sometimes that return is not an option.
Right. Or the rescue won't take the dog back, or they say, well, we're going to just have to euthanize the dog, which puts the kind of the responsibility back on the owner. It's a really difficult scenario for those clients. But the demand, again, that we're seeing, I think if I'm it's interesting. We're talking about the puppy mill concept and how do we mass produce to meet the demand?
Right.
And so now people are going to and flying those poor dogs from the streets of Via de Bravo after their vacation and sticking them in an apartment in Manhattan for 10 hours a day.
Right.
Because they sometimes can't get a dog from the shelter that meets their needs.
I mean, and there's a shortage of good dogs. So many people contact me and contact other trainers that I know. They want to adopt a dog. They want to buy a dog. They want to get a dog. They just want a nice family pet. And it's really hard to direct them. Like, it's really hard to help somebody find a good puppy, a good dog of any kind.
Right. So let's move on to where you like to learn from. I know a lot, you have so many insightful ways of looking at things, and a lot of people are like, where does Sue get her information from? Where are your sources from that you like to go to? So you mentioned Jessica Heckman, who's wonderful.
Yes. Let's see. I mean, I know this sounds really incredibly stupid and naive, but Facebook links. Like, I have so many smart Facebook friends who are also scientists, and they post links. And so I actually get a lot of really great links and scientific articles from at least my Facebook feed. So I like that. I'm an avid reader, and I read things other than, I mean, I read dog books, but I read a lot of things other than dog books. And, I've read a lot of Malcolm Gladwell, and recently his book Talking to Strangers was really appropriate for me. It resonated with me in terms of how I look at dogs, and how he was talking about society needing to, most of us need to trust that people are being honest and good, but you always need like the one doubter in society, but not everyone can be the doubter. And I think in terms of dogs, I think I'm the doubter, right? Like, people come to me and they're like, because they want, an honest assessment, and not just see all the good things. I can see all the good things, but I can also see all the risky and possibly problematic things. And a lot of times there's a place for that. So other forms of learning, my videos, oh my God. And I don't recommend that somebody get addicted to videos, but I videotape everything, and I review it over and over again, and I slow it down, and I have an idea. I'll notice something, and then I'll look for other videos to see if I can see similarities. So I study videos. I look at dog parks. I'll take one body part and obsess on it forever. Like, I just did a whole webinar a few months ago for the National Association of Canine Scent Work. It was on mouth behavior. So I did the minutia of panting and tongue and licking. And I took tongue flicks and I moved them, you know, I moved tongue flicks to a different part of our radar and panting. And anyway, minutia videos and shelters, go into a shelter, just do the same thing. Even if it's, you say to yourself, I'm going to go in front of every kennel, stand upright with my eyes, head and spine aligned. I'm not going to smile, or I am going to smile, and I'm going to extend my right hand palm out to the kennel and count to three, and do it with every single dog. And by doing the same thing, you're taking out a variable, and then you can see 100 dogs respond to that. And then, you know, better yet, wear a GoPro and do it, and then go home and study the footage. So that's my learning, is that what I know I need to learn more about learning theory and the technical stuff like that. And I haven't spent as much time with that, but I spend my time with my videos and in shelters and reading things having nothing to do with dogs that actually have a lot to do with animals, right?
Right, right. It's like you have more than 10,000 hour eyes on watching these things, but you also know what to look for. And you're doing it in a really interesting way. It was just really evaluating things, breaking things down, and doing it over and over to see how much it replicates.
Yes.
It's like you have all this data that I'm sure you'll have to unpack and continue to put out to the world.
You know, I was recently, you know, with the pandemic and everything, I was like, God, you know, I need a will. I really can't avoid that any longer. I need to write a will. And so, you know, so I, what am I asking? Like, okay, my house, I would leave my house, the land, definitely who's going to take my dogs. But for me, the other thing was, where am I going to, who's going to take on my video collection? Right? Like, that was a whole, like, I had to figure out who could be responsible for all of my videos. So it's a big thing.
So what are you up to now? What projects would you like to plug, or like, what would you like to talk about?
Yeah. So of course, cause I don't travel anymore since the pandemic hit, I've been doing webinars. So, at Puppy Works, instead of live, workshops, I'm doing four webinars in August, but I'll probably be doing a lot more webinars. Again, like, I'm doing one tonight. I know that we can't advertise that because it'll long be over. But the interesting thing is, every time I prepare for a webinar, like, my August webinars are all dog-to-dog behavior and aggression and play. And I gather the videos, and I try to gather all new ones as well, or get new ones. In the process of preparing a webinar, I will come up with like a bunch of new ideas, and I'm like, or observations. And I'm like, wow, look at that. Like, I wonder if that means something. So I find them really exciting. And I hope that the people that attend my webinars, I'm looking for their feedback. Like, I want to bounce some of these new ideas off of them. So I do them through Puppy Works. I advertise my schedule on my Facebook page, my personal page, which is my business page, is full of my 5,000 closest friends. And I have another Facebook page, the unlimited, more businessy kind. They're both called Sue Sternberg, so I don't know how to get you there. And I finished a website last night, SueSternberg.com. It was my website. I let it die and I resurrected it. And people can follow me there and find out what I'm doing.
Sue, thank you so much for joining me today. This was fascinating. As always, always wonderful to listen to you. And I hope everything goes well with the rest of your day and all the other webinars you're giving.
Thank you. And thanks so much for inviting me onto this. I consider it an honor. And I really appreciate you wanting to talk with me. And it was really fun. And I wish we could be at an outdoor cafe in Mexico, looking at street dogs with no pandemic and no masks.
We will do that again someday.
Okay, that would be great, Michael. Thanks.
Thanks for joining me for The Bitey End of the Dog. If you like the show, please feel free to subscribe, share, or give a rating to the episode. And don't forget to hop on over to aggressivedog.com or the Loose Leash Academy for more information about webinars, courses, and conferences all dedicated to helping dogs with aggression issues.